This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors Podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. We build this podcast out of a live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland called Out of Doors. This week I was accompanied by my colleague Helen Needham, and there was a distinctive watery theme throughout this. Hello and a very good morning to you. It's another cracking morning. Clear blue skies. There was frost in the windshield this morning, but the spire and the church in Midstocket Road is like Fireball XL5 pointing to the sky. It's magnificent. Pale grey granite in golden sunshine. I'm Mark Stevens, standing with him in the car park this morning with a homage to the 80s. She's got woolly leggings on at the bottom, I don't know why. Miss Helen Needham.
Leg warmers, I think you'll find.
Yeah, same difference.
Very handy for this time of year when you're not quite sure how many layers to wear.
You mean you might take them off at some stage?
Maybe, if I get a bit warm next to this sparky fire that you've got going
here. It is a sparky fire. I'd like to apologise for that.
Well, yeah. That's okay. I've forgiven you already.
Good.
Are you up bright and early? I was awoken by the moon this morning, actually.
The moon was good this morning.
Yes, I've been taking a lot of energy from the moon lately.
Uh-huh.
What are your plans for you today? You're getting out and about for a walk? Let us know. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk or text 80295. And you can call as well on 08085922. 95 00. Lewis is here to take your calls.
As you can hear, the car park here in the BBC sort of in Aberdeen is just full of birdsong. That's lovely.
And look at the way the lights on the trees there, on the beach trees.
Yeah.
Gorgeous.
Leaves still aren't out yet, but it's not going to be terribly long. I was further south earlier this week, and you know, it's coming out on the things like willow trees,
yeah.
Hawthorn trees. There was one point in Edinburgh, there were four of those Japanese cherry trees out in blossom.
Oh.
And unfortunately, because of the way the traffic was moving, I couldn't stop and photograph it, but it's just lifts your spirits, so it does.
It does indeed.
Last week, we had the vernal equinox. Tomorrow, the clocks change, so spring is officially here. Coming up this morning, I find out about the work to restore the Belty Burn near to Finns in Aberdeenshire. You've been on the hunt for frog spawn for some reason.
Yep. Well, it's the time of year for that as well, isn't it? It's all happening in the natural world. I took my six-year-old and she was on hand to help, armed with a bucket and a stick, and that's coming up soon. But first, Ewan may not be here, but he's here in spirit, so he's left us a mystery bird. Can you guess what this is? Have a guess. Do you know what bird makes that sound? You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk or text 80295, call Lewis on 08085 92 95 00.
This week, new legislation to bring about tougher penalties for dog attacks on livestock has been passed in the Scottish Parliament. Now, that move comes, as the National Sheep Association said, that cases of sheep worrying have increased over the past year of lockdown. Sheep worrying technically is when dogs chase and attack sheep, and it often results in injury, stress or even death for the sheep and any lambs they might be carrying.
It's even more of a concern for sheep farmers at this time of year as lambing gets underway and people want to get out and about with their dogs in the spring. I went to meet Kirsty Sutherland and her flock in Aberdeenshire, where a heavily pregnant yow was having a good old scratch.
She's a yow that I bought in as a yow lamb, and she's known as Yvonne. because she came from an estate called Torrish up in Sutherland, and my wee sister's best pal is known as Yvonne Torrish. So it was a no-brainer that she had to be called Yvonne.
She's quite large, isn't she?
Yeah, she's expecting triplets. She's very fat and uncomfortable and demanding at present.
So what kind of sheep are these and how many have you got?
I've got 60 breeding yows and they're all North Country Cheviots, hill type. And they all came from a flock that my dad started 30 years ago and he bought in 7 yows to start up his croft. And they're all descendants from that.
And lovingly looked after by yourself on your small farm here in Aberdeenshire. And you're gearing up for the lambing.
Yes, a fortnight today, it should all be kicking off, so that's why I look quite fresh-faced at the moment.
That'll probably be a different story in a month's time.
Yeah, no, different story in a month's time, yeah. They're, I would say, relatively spoilt, but if you're not going to look after them, don't have them, would be my motto. So they're very well looked after.
And you live quite close to a road here. You're in a rural area, really, but we're not so far from the town here. Have you noticed that there are more people wandering about with dogs since the lockdown a year ago?
Yeah, there's more pedestrians. There's a lot of my neighbours now are going for walks, which is really nice, actually, because they're appreciating the countryside and taking their dogs for a walk.
You see that as a positive thing, people being out and about enjoying the countryside, but it could pose as a serious problem for you and your sheep.
Oh, definitely. In the back of your mind, you're always worried. I mean, most dogs that I've seen around here are on leads, which is fine, but I'm always concerned if there's a dog off a lead, gets into the field of sheep, goodness knows what could happen.
And what could happen then?
The sheep will run. They're a prey animal that doesn't matter how calm my yows look at the moment, if something startles them, they will run. And then for a dog, that is play. They run, so the dog will automatically chase. And that's very stressful for the sheep. These yows at the moment, as you can see, are very heavily pregnant. And if a dog got in amongst these just now, that would be absolute carnage. The amount of lambs I'd lose would be horrific and the stress to the sheep would just be appalling. And the stress to me would be appalling, yeah.
But you're a dog owner as well. You have a very quiet Labrador.
Yes, but any dog is capable of it. You know, you've seen her there, she's quite quiet. Under the right circumstances, she could be involved in sheep warding. If another dog started it, the pack mentality could kick in, definitely. Any dog is capable of it, any breed, because it's just an instinct. Therefore, as a dog owner, it's up to me to make sure that I don't let my dog get into that situation and protect her from being led astray, if you like.
And have you ever had any experiences around here of that?
Yeah, I've actually, my yow lambs were, from where we're standing here, just 2 fields away. They spent the winter to over there. I feed them in the morning and then I would check them again at night. And after I checked them at night, I got a text message from my neighbour, really apologetic because her spaniel puppy had got in. He'd slipped the electric fence and he'd got in and he'd obviously just started running around and they ran. So he was running after them. And unluckily for him, luckily for us, the old pet yow was in there because I didn't want her near the top. And he ran up to her. And she just looked at him like, yeah, you and whose army, sunshine? You know, been there, done that, seen it all before. And the game stopped and the owner managed to get his attention and he ran back. And she was really, really apologetic that this had happened and said, you know, they're all fine. I've looked at them, they're fine, but we'll check them again in the daylight and make sure. And they were all fine. It was just yow lambs are quite robust. And he's just a puppy, you know, it was bound to happen. But the important thing is she told me, she said to me, look, this has happened, I'm really sorry. Another neighbour's dog got in a few weeks later and did similar. It was an older dog and again she got in touch with me straight away, very apologetic, and has since sought a bit of professional help with that dog. But she's, you know, she said she would never let, you know, the dog off the lead in your livestock again. She was quite shocked that it happened and, you know, her eyes were opened. And I was quite calm about it because it was my yow lambs and there was no harm done. But I did reiterate, if that had been 2 fields closer at home and that had been in with my breeding yows, I would not have been that calm about the situation, that a lot of damage could have happened because they were just very newly in lamb at that stage.
What would you have done?
If a dog was in chasing my sheep just now and the owner could get no control, I would have no qualms about phoning somebody with a rifle. And as a dog owner, that's quite a hard thing to say, but you just can't have it, you know. And they do say if they get a taste for blood, they'll do it again because it's a game and they've been rewarded. So, yeah, if there's a dog in the sheep and it's out of control, I'm sorry, but it's a one-way ticket, from my point of view, anyway. It's a constant worry. I mean, my yows are all at home here. You can see them. I can see them most of the time. My yow lambs are out of sight. You know, they're a sort of quarter mile up the road. And I don't know what's going on up there. And there could be people passing with dogs. And it is something that is at the back of your mind something that I do worry about. I'm a complete control freak with my sheep, as everybody who knows me will tell you. And I do my best for them as far as disease or pests and nutrition. And these are all things I can kind of control, whereas the worrying is something I've got no control over. It could happen any time, any day.
What would you advise people to do then who are out and about? Because we all know that more people are getting out into the countryside and that more people are getting puppies, actually. There's a whole new wave of puppies. What would you advise them to do if they're anywhere near sheep?
Just keep your dog on a lead. It doesn't matter how well-trained you think your dog is whenever they're anywhere near livestock or potentially near livestock. You might be going past a very large field and you think there's nothing in it, but over the brow of the hill, there could be a lot of sheep. So, yeah, just keep your dog on a lead in areas like that. When you're in the countryside, enjoy it. It's a great place to be, but just have a bit of respect for the people who are just trying to go about their daily business in it and rear livestock in it. And yeah, I can think of nothing more traumatic than coming across a field of yows, you know, that have been attacked by dogs. That's something that would just be horrific as a sheep owner, but more horrific for the sheep. Very stressful.
Kirsty Sutherland, who farms near Aberdeen. Now, I have true confession here. When I was, we were just newly married, so probably only about 22, 23, something like that. We had a wee dog called Penny, wee black thing. All dogs have the hunting instinct. And we stayed in a wee tied cottage, and next door there was a field of sheep, and there was a gap in the fencing and what have you. And she got in there and just started. Now, it wasn't, thankfully, at lambing time or even before lambing time. But the farmer came down and was justifiably raging. Of course, at that age, I was, you know, chest out. Oh, what's anything? But then I thought about it and thought, no, actually, this is my issue. This is my problem. It's my dog. I have to control it. So I went back and apologised to him and said, can you give me the stuff? And I will repair the gaps in the fencing, you know, and just do it. You remember John File used to farm up round about here? I went along to him one time when they were clipping. Now, he knew that there'd been dogs chasing his sheep at one stage, and when the fleeces were coming off, you could see the injuries underneath the fleece. You can't always see it until the fleece comes off. It's not good. Not
very good. Simple. Just keep your dog on a lead when you're anywhere near livestock.
Yes.
However good your dog is.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a simple, responsible thing that you can do.
Well, the problem with me and Penny was, you know, we used to sort of go in and out the back door all the time, whatever, and the dog had just gone out by itself. I hadn't taken the dog out, the dog had gone out by itself. So, but again, you're right, it's a security issue. The human is responsible, it's not the dog.
Yeah.
You know, so. Anyway, Claire Aldred, moving on from dogs to horses seamlessly, as if it were deliberate. Claire Aldred's based in the northeast of Scotland. For a number of years, she's been exploring the landscape in her neck of the woods and beyond, sometimes for days on end. Doesn't go alone, though. Her chums on these treks are two horses, Yogi and Swift. So where all does she go to?
Well, there's quite a lot of trails were created originally for horses in mind, like the old drover's routes and, you know, and old cart tracks for trade. They're probably not maintained as they would have been back then, but there are plenty of routes that are very suitable for horses. And anything really that a bike can go down, then a horse can go down.
Hang on, wait. I can lift my bike across a gate. You can't do that with a horse.
No, you can't. So I do have to go out and recce some of the routes that I do before I set off to make sure there's not obstacles like that, locked gates or stiles or cattle grids with no side gates. Yeah. You know, they do stop a trek with a horse. So you have to know that you can go there and find an alternative.
When you go out, okay, you recce the route, you head out on the route. I said you can be away for days at a time, anything up to a week. Have you ever done longer?
Yes. So my longest trip so far was crossing all the way across Scotland from near St Cyrus on the east coast to near Glen Elg on the west.
Wow.
And that took nearly 3 weeks.
That must have been fabulous.
It was amazing, yes. It was amazing. And I've also done many other sort of two-week treks since then, circumnavigated the Cairngorms, for example.
Wow. And have you got backup at all?
Yes, I have backup. I always make sure that I've got a few friends on standby that would maybe meet me with a horse trailer or something if I needed to extract from the situation I was in. And my husband's very, very good at supporting me to get to the start, pick me up at the end, meet me in the middle with some clean clothes and extra food. And he also monitors my progress to make sure that I'm doing okay.
How does he do that?
So I carry a GPS device that plots my progress every 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then it also has a text message service that at the end of the day I can just text my husband and say, this is where I'm camping for the night and I'm okay. Yeah. And that feeds back into a computer system that he can see where I'm at.
And if you're static for too long at the wrong time of the day,
then he'll give me a ring and just see if there's any mobile signal, yeah, first of all. And then if there's no mobile signal, he'll send me a text message on the satellite device, and then I can answer and say, yeah, I'm okay, I'm just having a snooze.
Yeah. Well, don't, you know. Just get on with it. What's the scariest sort of situation you found yourself in out with these ones?
I've had several. Once I was up Glen Feshey, which is a very, very nice glen, one of my favourites, and I was on a trail that just got narrower and narrower. It was steep up to the left and steep down to the right, and Yogi, who was following me, I was actually walking at the time, thankfully, he just stepped off. Whether he got distracted, I'm not sure, but he just stepped off and fell down the slope. And yeah, only by pure luck, really, as to where I had the ropes connected to him and from Swift to him, did I manage to break his fall, and he didn't hurt himself.
Yeah. Again, if folk aren't accustomed to horses, you think, well, the horse falls down, it gets up again. Sometimes not that straightforward.
No, and there was no mobile signal at all in that glen, so it was all the what-ifs afterwards, you know, thinking, what if he had hurt himself? He only had small cuts and bruises. But, you know, I was thinking, what if he'd broken a leg or anything like that? I'd have really been in difficulty to try and get help, and that was what made me carry the GPS device. But another scary one I've had is just unpredictable weather. So I got caught out in a storm. I kind of knew it was coming. I'd heard a bit of a weather forecast, but it was much worse than they'd anticipated. So I had gone further down a glen one night to make sure that I wasn't in the worst of it. But when I woke up in the morning, it was really, really raging. The horses were shivering. I struggled to get the gear on them to get out of that situation. They couldn't have stayed there another 24 hours in that storm. So I basically had to bug out, and I found, thankfully, a youth hostel that was willing to take me and the horses in. They had a shelter behind, and they got me hay and straw. And
how lucky was that?
Oh, godsend. I'm never concerned about myself. I can get warm and get in my tent, but I was really concerned about the horses. And I have to admit, when the postman said to me, go to that house, they'll help you, I did cry, because I was just so relieved to find something to help the horses in that situation.
Yeah. Well, as we were discussing earlier, it's a partnership. Yeah, and you must feel responsible.
But totally responsible. I mean, it's not their ambition to cross Scotland or go right round the Cairngorms. They enjoy it, they do. But I'm the one that has the responsibility on my shoulders of keeping them safe.
Yeah. I know your day job is as a paramedic. What you do, I mean, this is kind of standing the question on its head, what you do with the horses, has it informed what you do as a paramedic? Has it given you skills or aptitude, resilience, that you probably wouldn't have had before?
Definitely. I think doing any outdoor sport, it gives you self-confidence, self-esteem, resilience. But I think in the way that I deal with the horses, you know, horses are very, very good at picking up on if you get nervous or excited, then they'll get nervous and excited. And often that doesn't give you a very good outcome with two flight animals whose natural instinct to anything that might be exciting or nervous is to run. At least putting on a calm exterior, whether you feel that way on the inside or not. And I've obviously taken that on to my paramedic job, where people have called us because they are having an exciting or anxious time. Yeah. And, you know, emotions are running high. And if you go in there with a very calm attitude, even though you might not be feeling it inside, it calms the whole situation down and you normally get a better outcome.
Yeah.
And Claire's just published a book about one of our long-distance treks called From East to West by Saddle is Best. And you can hear more from Claire on the Scotland Outdoors podcast. Just head to BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcast from. Heaps more coming up, including the second of our pieces from producer and blogger Penny Latton, talking about how the outdoors has helped in her recovery from cancer. And, of course, this week's mystery bird.
We have a correct answer already.
Get out of here,
never. I'm not joking.
Wow.
Gary and Penny Cook, well done.
Well, tell you that. Awesome. Seriously impressive.
Some others here. Is it a house sparrow working on the hill doing ground prep for tree planting 50 hectares? What a braw morning. I'm not sure who that is, but sounds like a good thing to be doing on such a fine day. Is it a sparrow hawk? That's Bailey from Exeter. Hope you're having a well-earned holiday, Ewan. I'm sure he is.
No, he's actually stuck inside his Victorian rhubarb forcer.
I can't believe you actually said that. That was our little joke.
You know, he's got all these gadgets and gigaws and what have you. What's it? It's the asparagus knife and things like that. And he's got this Victorian rhubarb forcer. I think it's the naughty step in their family. Get in the forcer. Go on you go. You've been told.
Anyway, Jude is saying, think the mystery bird is that pesky jay which comes in gangs to gorge on my squirrel feeder. No, sorry. And Fiona in Pool U says, is it a twite?
No.
No, it's not.
No, it's not. It's not. It's a lovely bird, but I'm really astonished anybody's got it off the, you know, what we've played
well,
so far.
We have a lot of expert listeners to this programme.
Yeah, I suppose. Right, let's just hear the sound again, just in case you missed it the first time. Yeah, no, no way I would have got it off that.
Well, if you think you know what it is, you can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295, and you can call as well 0808592 95 00, and that's Lewis, who's on the phones waiting for your phone call. We got an email about last week's mystery bird, actually, which was a water rail, and this is from Sarah in Inverness, who says, I usually listen in bed on a Saturday morning and have to shush my 7-year-old Hugh. Oh, I know that feeling. Who comes in and squawks through the mystery bird answers before we get up. I now would like a warning issued for all of you with tender ears and impressionable children, as I had to suffer an uncanny impression of a water rail for most of Saturday.
Yes. And just to remind you, the water rail is also known as the water pig. Mm. So, you know, that in your lug all day is not going to be a good thing.
Mm. Mm. See, I'm tempted to ask you to do an impression, but I don't want to annoy Sarah.
Yes. I thought we have warned.
Yes, yeah, warning.
Warning. Our colleague Kevin Keane, BBC Scotland's Environment, Energy and Rural Affairs correspondent, has spent the last few months putting together a disclosure documentary called How You Can Stop Climate Change. Now, we're going to be talking to Kevin just shortly, but first, here's a clip from the programme. This is Julie Gibson, a historian in Orkney, talking about the Neolithic site of Skara Brae.
You see, right in the middle of the house, there's a sort of square outline of stones. That's where the fire would have been. It's not far by what some estate agents say is a fixer-upper, really.
What are your concerns about the threat to it now from rising sea levels and more sea storms? Because it is quite precariously placed next to the sea, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And rising sea levels are a considerable threat to this site. Storms that we would reckon to be one every 50 years or 100 years do come up and they do damage.
That damage is minimised by this seawall, but Julie concedes the fight to keep hold of Skara Brae might not be one they can win.
We're quite anxious to look after this site for as long as we can. It might not be forever, but we can keep it going, I think, for some generations, while we hopefully get climate change under control.
Archaeologist Julie Gibson in Orkney there, talking to Kevin Keane. Kevin joins us on the line now. Good morning, Kevin.
Morning, Mark. How are you doing?
Not bad at all. Yeah, interesting. Skara Brae is possibly not somewhere that would immediately spring to mind when you were thinking about climate change, but, I mean, essentially, there's massive amounts of archaeology around about the coast of Orkney that's disappearing on a daily basis.
Absolutely. And interestingly, we had a drone flying above Skara Brae to look down on the site. And from that vantage point, you can really see quite starkly how under threat it is, because there's a seawall there that's been there for about 100 years. And basically, the coast either side of it is just disappearing. It's kind of being eaten away by the sea. So you heard that interesting admission there from Julie saying that, you know, they might not be able to save it forever if climate change continues to get kind of out of control, you know, and sea levels continue to rise, because you'll end up with so much energy in the weather systems and in the sea storms, you know, that they might end up overtopping something like that sea defence or going around the side of it or some, you know, some other such way of kind of destroying it or getting into it, which has happened before.
Kevin, take us back to the beginning of all this. How did the idea for this programme come about in the first place?
Well, it was quite an interesting genesis, actually, Helen, because it started out, like a lot of these documentaries, it started out as one thing and then kind of morphed into something slightly different. So I wanted to have a look initially at how bad things can get in Scotland, because essentially I think many people think that climate change is something that's going to impact other parts of the world. And to a degree, in terms of severity, that's right. You know, you've got a lot of small island nations in the Pacific that are entire countries that are going to disappear. And partially have already as the sea levels continue to rise. You know, we're never going to get it as bad as that here, that is true, but we're already feeling some of the impacts. So we looked at things like drought, which is a thing in Scotland that's going to get worse and is happening already. We're looking at rising sea levels, and we're looking at wildfires, which again are already significantly greater in number than they were just 10 years ago. So that was the start of it. And then I had a bit of a moment at the start of winter, sort of back end of the autumn at home, that made me question, you know, my own ability to tackle some of these issues. Essentially, my gas boiler, I've got a house that's about 15 years old, the boiler's the same age, the boiler stopped working, and after much wrangling, to my eternal shame, I've replaced it with another gas boiler, having gone through a big process of trying to look at putting in something renewable. In the end, I went for this gas boiler, which I kind of explain a bit in the programme. But it led me to think, what, you know, if it's difficult for me, someone who, you know, kind of reads a lot about the science, reports a lot on it, talks a lot on programmes like Reporting Scotland about these being some of the solutions, and then actually ultimately when it came down to it, you know, did I make the right decision? No. So we look at that. We commissioned a survey which asks a lot of people about, you know, their intentions, whether they'd like to do some of these things, and practically whether they have done or will do. And we find some quite surprising results from that.
It's interesting, Kevin, because I found myself in exactly that same situation. I mean, nearly 20 years ago, I looked at our house and thought, right, how can I, you know, how can I make this more energy efficient? How can I make this greener? And we looked at all sorts of things. I mean, small-scale wind turbines and ground source heating systems and blah, blah, blah. But you've got to balance up the cost, because, I mean, these things are not cheap, because you're trying to retrofit a lot of this stuff and not cheap. And when it came down to it, what made most economic sense for me was to seriously insulate my house.
Absolutely, absolutely. And cost essentially is a big, big factor in this. It wasn't the only factor for me, because the thing that I'd been considering was an air source heat pump, which costs about £10,000 to put in. But there are various grants and subsidies that pay about three quarters of that. And ultimately, the system I put in cost fractionally more. But there were various barriers in the way. It would have taken weeks and weeks to actually sort this. And when it stopped working, the first thing I did was I phoned a plumber, and the plumber said, I'll be around within the hour, and obviously he was 2 hours. And then I immediately phoned Home Energy Scotland and had a long conversation with them. They talked to me about my options and what was possible. And literally, as I put the phone down, 2 hours later, the plumber arrived, and the conclusion I'd come to with Home Energy Scotland was it couldn't be done for various reasons, not least I've got a young baby in the house and another older child. We were heading into the winter and we suddenly had no heating, so I needed something that could be done quite quickly, and the whole process, the application system to get one of these systems in, would have taken weeks, possibly months to get through, and you can't apply for it retrospectively. So that was essentially the end of the line for me. I mean, the system I've got is much more efficient. It's a modern gas boiler, and they're more efficient than the old ones, but it is still locking me in for the next 10 to 15 years to continuing to burn fossil fuels.
Well, chaps, I'm disappointed, because I was in exactly the same boat, and we took the plunge and we got an air source heat pump.
Yeah.
Because I just...
I know, shame.
I know, shame on you. But it wasn't easy. It really wasn't easy. And it was very difficult to find a plumber who would actually do it and was prepared to do it, because we live in an old granite house. So it's not straightforward. And I think that's the point, actually, that a lot of people just go for the easy option and the cheaper option because it is easier and cheaper.
Yeah. Well, and
interesting...
Sorry, carry on, Kevin.
I was going to say, interestingly, we've visited a couple in Tarland in Aberdeenshire who had, quite an old home themselves, and, you know, it probably not massively well insulated by their own admission, and it was a freezing cold day when we were there, and, you know, I beg the question, you know, what about on a day like this? Were you worried about the fact that, you know, you might not be able to get enough heat out of this perishing cold air? And you know, he said, It's brilliant. He loves it.
Yeah. Well, I've actually been in a zero energy house just about, I think it was round about Ellen. They're astonishing things. I mean, basically just heated up. There's a lot we can do, but we need to change building regulations and all sorts of things. But do tune in to Kevin's programmes. You can see Disclosure, How You Can Stop Climate Change, this Monday evening at 7:30 on BBC One Scotland. Thanks for joining us, Kevin. Coming up, a new lease of life for a Deeside burn and the evolution of the frog. And we've got the fascinating tale of daylight savings. Don't forget the clocks go 1 hour forward at, what is it, 1 o'clock this morning? Sunday morning.
Like that,
Sunday
yeah.
morning, yeah, whatever.
Yeah. Yep.
You'll know.
Yes, indeed. But basically, by the time you wake up tomorrow, it'll be different.
It'll be a different time.
Yes. First, how are you getting on with this week's mystery bird? Have a listen. Interesting.
What's that in the background?
That's what I was wondering.
No idea.
Anyway, we've got a couple of guesses here. Mari and Kyle in Oxford are saying, could it be a hen harrier?
It could be, but it's not.
And morning people, I reckon that today's mystery bird is a tree sparrow. I often hear them at the Benham Mill. Thank you in anticipation and best wishes, Michael Craig from sunny Johnshaven. Keep them coming.
Yeah, all good guesses, but no.
We've only had one correct answer so far.
Yeah.
So email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295, and you can call on 08 085 92 95 00.
We're not going to rename that person who got the correct answer because nobody likes a swat.
No, but we might say it again at the end of the programme.
Yeah, probably. It was seriously impressive getting as quickly as it did.
I mean, yeah, that was just Ewan's really going to be really annoyed about that, isn't he?
He won't know inside the rhubarb force.
No, that's right. He won't be able to hear.
Isolated from the outside world. At the end of last year, a project was completed to try and breathe new life into a burn. It's actually a bit somewhere between a burn and a river near Turfinns on Deeside. The burn's natural course had been diverted a couple of hundred years ago to make way for a railway and to sort of make life easier for farmers. I went along to see what had been happening in the company of Dr. Susan Cooksley. Susan's an ecologist at the James Hutton Institute and manager of the Dee Catchment Partnership.
The Belty Burn would have been a very twisting channel that ran right through the middle of this wetland, right over those fields as far as you can see that way, and across to the other side of the valley floodplain area. And if we look at a map, you can see it's got this really twisting channel that goes through. But about 250 years ago, I guess, the straightening and draining of this area would have begun for agricultural improvements, followed by the coming of the railway line and additional reinforcement. And the end result of that was the Belty Burn, which we'll see as we walk further up, which until last year was a dead straight,
deeply canalised
burn that was just running straight along this 1 or 2 kilometre length. Can I just show you on
that?
Yeah,
sure.
Just to give you a feel for where we are. Now, we are here.
Right.
So just at the outflow of this wetland area, which didn't exist at the beginning of last summer. And we've been talking about the railway line, which runs this 1 kilometre length down here. And the old Belty Burn took a course just dead alongside that railway line all the way down. And what we've done is blocked that off completely. We've dug out a brand new complex of 3 interlinked wetlands that then flow back into this brand new meandering channel, which works its way down to the bottom of the site. And what we're looking at here is that outflow point. We were determined that we didn't want to transport any soil off the site, so we had to make sure that we could incorporate it within our design. And most of that cut material, or a lot of that cut material, went to filling in the old channel. But because we're trying to create as many different habitats as possible, where we could, we've left little backwaters or little damp areas, and we were able to leave just this little bit of the old Belty Burn just as an extra area of habitat. Might be good for dragonflies, water vole, things like that. So we're just trying to pack as many different habitats as possible into the site.
Create possibilities.
That's right.
Yeah. We're just walking up this railway line, and there's a boggy section on our right-hand side. I had lapwing there.
Yep, we've got a flock of about 7 or 8 lapwing, and we've seen a fair number of oyster catchers as well. Yep.
Yeah. So effectively, what you were trying to do here was to take a landscape that was almost, not industrialised is the wrong word, but I mean, you know, it'd been made stupidly functional in one particular sense, but it closed off so many other possibilities.
Functional from the point of view of draining land, but functionless from the point of view of nature, flood reduction, climate resilience, you name it, all the other things that we rely on rivers to do for us, or that they could do for us if we would allow them, were just not happening within the old burn. I mean, where we're standing, you would have looked at about, well, you can see the height of the bank over there. It's maybe 3 metres high. Mm-hmm. When flows come up, the river can't join onto its floodplain, which is absolutely part of the river system itself. Instead, it's just channeled like a hose straight downstream onwards to Glassell and Bankery, and at some point it's going to break out and flood, and all of that energy, all of that erosion, all of the soil and silt is taken onwards downstream.
All that velocity too,
yes,
because it is a bit like, you know, restricting the end of a hose. You're just shooting that force further downstream.
That's right, and it cannot break out. Whereas now you can see we've got these very gentle banks, and as the burn comes up, it simply slops out onto its floodplain, which it would have done in the past. The whole area fills up, and when you get lower down, the water that's coming out is, it's just flowing quite slowly. It's mm-hmm. just taking its time. We had a big flood, Storm Alex, during the middle of the restoration work, and so the works were, you know, maybe a quarter done. And all we could do was stand pretty much where we are now and just look at everything underwater and think, well, you know, what we come back to. But the water's dropped in a couple of days, and far from there being eroded soil and everything having been destroyed, it was untouched to the extent that you could see footprints in the bank, you could see the digger tracks. Nothing had been eroded away because the heat had been taken out of the system, because the water had been allowed to get where it wanted to be, out onto the floodplain. We've built a connected group of three small lochs, which will, because they're quite shallow, they will become much more like wetlands, albeit with a flow through them. At the moment they look very lake-like, but that will change over time as they fill in.
I'm not by any manner of means wanting to diminish what you've achieved here, because you must have shifted tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of cubic metres of soil to achieve this. But this has to be the ultimate lockdown project.
It was. I mean, it was stressful and very hard work, but we'd built up to this over the course of 2 years. And at the beginning of lockdown, we were just at the point of getting our planning permission and our licensing. And myself and my colleague from the Fishery Board, Edwin Third, who managed the project with me, we just decided we had to make this happen, especially in such a difficult year, to make something so good happen. And for us personally, but also for everyone who'd been working on the project. So we just went for it. And because other work areas perhaps weren't happening, it just gave us that opportunity to focus. We didn't finish until November, so you can imagine it was a very long, hard summer. But it was just such a joy to achieve it.
Dr. Susan Cookley there at the James Hutton Institute. We'll hear more from Susan shortly, but you know, part of the reason for doing that was to sort of try and encourage wildlife back into the area. Mm-hmm. You will not believe how quickly that happened. I mean, it's astonishing. You create a gap, nature will find it and start to fill it up.
Yeah, amazing. But there's nothing more beautiful, is there, than a meandering burn or river.
Yeah.
I was up Glenderry recently, and mm-hmm. you just look at the way the burn goes when you're high up, and it's just, it's that gorgeous. It's the natural way for it to be, isn't it?
There's something about that. This is maybe completely fanciful. I think there's something about that shape, because the way your eye follows it, it does something to the sort of rhythm to your brain.
Yes.
It just kind of slows it down. I don't know why.
But it does slow the flow.
It slows the flow of the water.
Yeah, exactly. There's actually a picture of the Belty Burn up on Radio Scotland social media channels at the moment, the Radio Scotland Facebook page and on Twitter, if you want to have a look at that.
Things are definitely beginning to stir out in the countryside at the moment. I mean, spring has definitely arrived. Birds are busy preparing for nesting, frogs, toads, newts, everything. Everything's on the move.
It is indeed. And with that in mind, I thought I'd take my daughter Flora, who's age 6, out to look for frog spawn, which is a very simple lesson in the fundamentals of the life cycle.
A lifetime of frogs. So this is one thing. frogs lay their eggs and then they just leave. And then they hatch and they go in the, and they sing in the pond until they turn into frogs, and that's when they lay their eggs, and then they leave their eggs and it keeps going on. So it's a frog spawn.
Yeah.
Then a tadpole.
Yep, and then what happens?
And then it has two back legs, and then it turns a different colour. And then it gets its front legs, and then it turns into to a frog, but it doesn't have its tail anymore.
Right, well, we're off to the pond.
I've got a stick and a bucket, because I'm sure there's going to be some frog spawn.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed when I was out the other day that the frogs and toads are on the move. Have you ever seen any frogs and toads on the move?
Well, once a long time ago, I saw one smaller frog on top of another frog, and that other frog that was on top of the other frog was actually walking, managing to hold the other one so on top of it.
What do you think was going on there, Flora?
The mum was carrying the dad.
Hmm, do you think that's fair?
I don't know, it might be just something that happens in life.
Well, just approaching the pond, and crikey, it was only a few weeks ago that we were actually enjoying this for a whole different reason, Rasmus.
We were ice skating on the pond.
I know, we lovingly manicured this pond, if that's the right terminology. Oh, no way, that easy. My goodness, I thought there was going to be more of a hunt. Just at the edge. Oh my goodness, you've caught some already. Now, I think you better put some pond water in that bucket first. Managed to capture some on the edge of the stick. I don't think we need to take too many because we don't actually have a large tank. What does it look like?
It's like some kind of lumpy stuff that have tiny black dots. That is the frog spawn. They're just tiny.
Yeah. Did you notice something about the pond water?
Dirty?
Yeah, it looks dirty, but that's a good thing, I think, because that means it's got plenty of things going on there, which hopefully will help to keep these little beasts alive.
Mm-hmm.
Could you possibly fill up that watering can with some extra pond water, please? And if you could possibly gather a few of these plants, little plants, that would be good as well, because I think that's going to be good nutrients for these tadpoles.
We're going to take it home and put it in something a bit bigger. Yeah, bigger. And we are going to...
You're swinging it around quite a lot there.
We're going to leave the water. We're not going to change it or anything. Because it might make the frog spawn quite not very well. Because if you change the water and make it clean, it is really bad for the frog spawn.
Yep.
So it's good to just leave that normal water and then leave it and leave it. But when they're quite big, release them back into the same pond. Because if you change them to a different pond, they might spread something kind of yeah. So it's very serious when you're dealing with frog spawn. You've got to know what you're doing with it.
Well, Helen, we've worked together for a long time, and it's been good. Don't get me wrong, it's been good, but I mean, sadly, you are fired and she's hired. Yeah, that kid is brilliant.
I'm too old now.
You're too old now, too old. We need that new, fresh approach.
Yeah. Keeping it real.
Yeah. She's wonderful. Joining us now to tell us more about what frogs and toads are up to in the northeast is Kirsten Mayer, Seasonal Reserve Assistant at the Nature Scott Muir of Dinnet Reserve. Morning, Kirsten, how are you?
Good morning. I'm great. The weather's looking fabulous today so far.
Delighted to hear it. Listen, you've got frogs and toads on the reserve. Just remind us, what's the difference between the two? How can you tell them apart?
Right. Well, there's several ways that you can tell the difference. I think the biggest telltale signs are that toads are kind of bumpy skinned. They're warty looking, while frogs are quite sleek and smooth. I think the other way to tell is where you'll find them. So at the moment, we have got hundreds of toads on our path, and they are making their way overland to our breeding ponds. But frogs are much more kind of moist-skinned, so they need to stay close to water all the time. So if you see either a frog, if you see an amphibian on the land, it's bound to be a toad, really. And it's the way they move, their locomotion. Frogs have got very long legs and they're quite athletic looking, whereas toads are quite squat and sturdy and they kind of hobble across, waddle their way across land. So that's, they're easy differences, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's, I think actually the thing that Flora was talking about, the time that we saw a frog carrying another one, I think that was definitely toads, come to think of it.
It could well be the females with the toads that we're seeing just now. The females are huge in comparison to the males. Mm. And the males are very lazily piggyback riding.
Even
the
though
females.
The female's full of eggs?
No, she's not yet. So if you see them moving, they're probably moving to a pond to breed.
Right.
They have to be in the water. That kind of triggers their whole reproduction cycle. Once in the water, the female unfortunately gets quite mobbed by the males, and they clamber onto her. They kind of clasp her tightly, and that triggers her egg laying.
And it can be quite a noisy business, I believe.
I've heard so there's a mating call, which is quite a gentle croak. But I discovered a breeding pond on one of our lochs last weekend, and it was full of squeaks.
See, when you started talking about, or when Flora started talking about, you know, the one, you know, toad piggybacking on the other, you know, I was smiling to myself, thinking, well, I know what that's about, but I'm not sure that I do know what it's about now. Why do the males piggyback on the females?
It's, I think, to start sort of encouraging her into an egg-laying behaviour once they do arrive.
So is it getting up close and personal type thing?
Absolutely, and obviously it's sheer laziness also.
Yeah, I'm saying nothing.
And what about the newts then? What's happening with them?
Well, with the newts, their whole courtship is quite different. They actually, the males have to woo the female a little bit with some tail wiggling behaviours, and she will actually choose a male to mate with and offer up an egg sac for him to fertilise. So it's a gentler experience for the female. A bit more finesse involved, really.
And you've got adders on the reserve as well, because I've seen them there. Any sign of them emerging yet?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Our males are out in force just now. Routinely on a patrol, we see about, well, the highest I've seen are 7 male adders.
Wow.
And they're shedding. They're in the process of shedding at the moment. So if you come upon one and you notice that their eyes are cloudy, that means that they're kind of a day into the shedding process. The boys emerge before the females, and that shed makes them look pristine for the mating ritual that's just about to commence.
Once they've shed their old skin, you mean, just describe it for me. What do they look like?
Once they're shed, they look sort of like, well, enamel jewels. I mean, they're incredibly pristine. The males that we have come in kind of all kind of size ranges, but we get olive males, we get fairly green looking males, and yeah, they just shine in the sun, really. You can tell the difference. The males have a black zigzag pattern down their backs, and the females have a brown chocolatey zigzag pattern. They tend to be a bit bigger as well. So we saw our first female 2 days ago.
Great. And you've got catkins as well, some exciting catkins.
Yes, no, this is amazing. Our aspen trees are producing catkins just now. They produced them in 2019, but before that, it was 23 years ago since they produced catkins. And the exciting part is that aspen generally reproduce asexually. So they push up kind of running suckers, which are clones of the parent tree. Mm-hmm. But with this sexual reproduction, so we've got male trees and we've got female trees. So far, we've discovered male catkins. We need to find the female catkin. Yeah. And the male catkins produce pollen, which fertilise the female flower. And the trees can actually set seed, and this seed is of massive conservation value. We have companies from across the UK coming together our seeds, which can then be reintroduced into other aspen stands and just kind of shake up the genetic variability, really.
It effectively is like hybrid vigour. You know, you've got much stronger plants because they are geographically separate. I mean, it's been fantastic talking to you, Kirsten. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Same to you. I look forward to the time when I can get back out to the Muir Dinn. It's a lovely reserve.
It really is, and there's all sorts going on. It's just such an exciting time to be out and about, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I've yet to see the Burn of Vat in Speed.
Mm.
I really quite fancy that, because it's like a fire hose shooting out the front.
Yeah.
You know? Anyway, you're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. She's Helen Needham. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
You can catch up whenever you like by looking up the programme on BBC Sounds.
Or download the Free Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. We like hearing where you listen to the podcast. You can email us that information at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Nikki Titchener in Adelaide did. She says, thank you so much for continuing to broadcast in such difficult times and to keep the programme so entertaining, varied and informative. Well, thanks very much for that. In Australia, overseas travel is still off limits until much later in the year. And it's sad for those of us who are exiled from Scotland that we can't plan to return anytime soon. So I'm very happy that the podcast keeps me connected and helps me plan for better times.
As we're not too restricted in Australia just now, we have recently travelled up to Arkaroola, about 600 kilometres from Adelaide. It has a fascinating geological and indigenous history, and we were lucky enough to go on a ridgetop tour and see yellow-footed rock wallabies in the wild. I was also impressed by the resilience of plant life in such a dry and harsh environment. Here's an example, and she sent in a picture of a plant sort of clinging to these dry rocks. Anyway, thank you again for making life easier for us. Greeting expats are the best. Nikki, longing to see Murray again.
This is Out of Doors. I'm Mark Stephen. She's Helen Needham. Coming up on Radio Scotland later today at 11:30, Des Clark is here with Breaking the News, along with guest Felicity Ward, Ahir Shah, Mark Nelson and Elaine Malcolmson.
And there's still time to hazard a guess at our mystery bird this week. Here's your final chance.
And it's not... We've only got one correct answer so far, which is astonishing at this stage. So what I'm going to... Am I on fire again?
Yes.
Oh, not again. That's another pair of trousers burnt. The love of goodness. Anyway, as I say, we've only got one correct answer for the mystery bird this week. It's obviously extremely difficult. So I'm going to give you a clue. It is not... It doesn't get its name because of any association with a native soft fruit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to leave it at that.
get in touch, email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. You can text 80295 and you can call as well on 08085 92 95 00, and Lewis is here to take your call.
Anyway, what's your preference? An extra hour in bed over the winter months, or are you looking forward to springing forward as of 1 o'clock tomorrow morning? Mr. McElroy has been finding about the man behind daylight savings time.
Get up, Grandpa. Don't you know it's daylight saving time?
Yeah, I know it. I don't know who in the world ever got it up. It don't do nobody a bit of good.
Daylight saving, in one form or another, has been around for a long time. Some folk love it, and others, well, others are less than enthusiastic, especially, it would seem, the Americans, 70% of whom would scrap it tomorrow, as they just don't get it.
I'm a-hunting that man who first thought up daylight saving time. Until he moved the clocks around, everything was a-going fine. But I guess he's hid and won't come out. He knows he's out of line. I get up late, have to wait, can't keep it straight. Who did he hate? I mean the man that first thought up daylight saving time.
But going back a bit, from the ancient Romans to Benjamin Franklin, a form of daylight saving has been used for many centuries. The Romans used to adjust their water clocks every month to keep in time with nature. But it took a little-known English builder and the First World War to get it finally adopted in the UK. So, picture the scene. One William Willett was riding his horse on the outskirts of London early one morning in the spring of 1905. The sun was well up, but William noticed most of the curtains and blinds of London were still closed. He thought about it long and hard, feeling something was wrong with the system of time. If it was light outside and the birds were up, why were folk living in the dark? Now, he chewed over this idea till it became an obsession. He was convinced that the people of this island would benefit from more daylight if the clocks were moved forward by 80 minutes between April and October. In 1907, he wrote a pamphlet entitled The Waste of Daylight. He proposed advancing the clock by 20 minutes every Sunday in April, then reversing the procedure in September of every year. And in the pamphlet he wrote, "Everyone appreciates the long light evenings. Everyone laments the shortage as autumn approaches, and everyone has given utterance to regret that the clear, bright light of an early morning during spring and the summer months is so seldom seen or used." Now, William was a wealthy man, and he spent most of his personal fortune spreading the word about the idea. He called for the establishment of summertime and began to lobby the British government. And to some extent, he succeeded. One Robert Pierce MP introduced a bill to the House of Commons in 1909. But the bill failed, and further attempts to reintroduce it were met with ridicule and opposition by members of Parliament. And those with farming interests were particularly resistant to the idea, because it disrupted their schedules and made it more difficult to get the most out of farm workers. And the animals didn't get used to changing the time they were being fed. And interestingly, criminals don't like daylight saving time either. Research by the University of Virginia shows extra daylight makes it harder for thieves to sneak in and out during the cover of night. So evening crime rates actually decrease when we get more sunlight. Unfortunately, in the autumn, it reverses back and the crime rate goes up when we lose the extra sunlight. Now, William Willett died in 1915 at the age of 58, and he would never see his idea put into use in the United Kingdom, just a year later, in 1916. But Britain wasn't the first. It was Germany that took the lead, in early 1916, introducing daylight saving time in an attempt to conserve electricity to help with the war effort. The German Empire and its ally Austria introduced daylight saving time on April the 30th, 1916. Only a few weeks later, the United Kingdom Parliament finally relented and introduced saving time for themselves. France and many other countries also introduced it around the world. But for most of these nations, the measure was only temporary. Most of them reverted to standard time after the First World War. And it wasn't until the Second World War that it was adopted around the world. Now, finally going back to Willett, who was the first to propose the establishing of daylight saving. But it was one of the fathers of the founding of the United States, Benjamin Franklin, who's credited with first floating the concept.
But daylight savings is a crying shame, and old Ben Franklin is the one to blame. Straightforward, the fallback.
Back in 1784, he wrote an essay, An Economical Project for Diminishing the Cost of Light. Now, he was living in France at the time, and Franklin calculated Parisians could save a whopping $200 million a year in today's money through savings in candles if they changed their sleeping patterns. Now, here's the sum, and stick with me on this because it gets really complicated. In the 6 months between the 20th of March and the 20th of September, there are 183 nights. The 7 hours of every night where they burn a candle. That gives you 1,281 hours. Now, the population of Paris is 100,000. That makes 128,100,000 hours spent lighting Paris by candlelight. Now, you take half a pound of wax and tallow per hour, and that gives the weight of 64 million, stick with us, 64,050,000 pounds in weight, which, estimating the whole at the median price of 30 sols to the pound, makes the sum of 96,075,000 livres. Using the exchange rate at the time, we get $200 million. Now, he didn't propose changing the clocks. He only wanted people to sleep at different times. So remember to put your clock forward and blame the lost hour on William Willett.
Well, I know you can do it because you got the knack. Spring forward, fall back.
I've seen McElroth trying to work out a bill in a restaurant. I'm not falling for that.
I know, I was thinking, like, has anyone actually checked these numbers?
Nope, absolutely not. The bottom line is, remember, move your clocks 1 hour forward when you go to bed tonight.
Yep.
Otherwise, yep. The usual confusion follows tomorrow.
Indeed. I've had a really good bit of correspondence there that I just can't find anymore, but the gist of it was from Doreen saying, we're talking about boilers earlier and so on. Which could have gone on for a long time, that chat, couldn't it?
Yeah, seriously, we could talk for Scotland on boilers.
Yeah, well, she was saying about the air source heat pumps, why they're so expensive here, but they're not that expensive everywhere else. In places like Scandinavia, they're quite common. But she also made the point as well that people should stop wearing T-shirts inside and start wearing wool.
Yes, that's good advice. That's good advice. You don't get this on John Beatty.
No, put your woolly...
Wool.
Indeed. That's put your woolly jumpers on, woolly socks, leg warmers, things like that.
I'm not doing the leg warmers. Seriously.
Why not?
Brian Burnett can pull it off, I can't.
Just come on, be free. Do you know what I got for my home office was a sheepskin that I sit on.
Ah, yes.
That's really good. And a nice woolly sheepskin from... near Tainault.
Uh-huh.
No, not Tainault. Tina this, Brewer.
Is that relevant?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm just pointing out Scottish stuff.
Right, fine.
And Tina Brewer. And then a little rug from Muck.
Ah, yes. Yeah, okay. Well, you see, I've been known to do entire Zoom calls with a Nocando woolen mill blanket across my legs.
Yeah.
It's very cosy warm.
Yeah, exactly. It makes you feel good.
You don't need central heating. You just
need wool.
Yeah. Wool. Anyway, we get any correct...
Yes, the correct answers have gone up since your last clue.
I thought it might.
Shall I just run through some wrong ones?
Yeah, go on.
Ross and Taynault saying, is the mystery bird a song thrush? I think Yuna definitely raised the bar on bird sound difficulty these days. Not as easy as it used to be.
He's got through all the easy ones.
I know.
That's the problem.
I was just saying to Laura, who's producing today, how long is this going to go on for?
Years and years. We've got a lot of birds.
It'll be some kind of obscure bird from Papua New Guinea before we know it. Alan Mark says, is it a peregrine falcon? Nope. Ian says, I don't know what bird it is, but recognise the tapping of a woodpecker when I went out with the dog earlier freezing morning. That'll do for me. Oh, so many woodpeckers at the minute tapping. It's great. Dougie says, House Sparrow, thank you for your wonderful tilt on life you give us every time. Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
And one final one. Lovely to wake up in the sunshine, says Mark from Inverness. Is it an osprey? A wild guess. Thanks.
We had a piece from Penny Latin on the programme last week, and in the background, she'd obviously recorded it in a garden, was a greater spotted woodpecker. You could hear it going, yeah. Mm-hmm. Penny is recovering from breast cancer. A year ago, she moved to the shores of Loch Ness, and so it was inevitable for somebody like her, somebody so active, that she would be drawn to the water eventually, and, she says, with remarkable results.
Now, like many people, one of the utter delights I've discovered over the past year is wild swimming. Unlike most people, I'm lucky enough to have a rather big swimming pool on my doorstep. So this morning, it's 7:30, it's a beautiful, beautiful morning, and I'm putting on my wetsuit up at the house so I can walk down the track and have a quick dip in the loch. I think there's something very special about living overlooking water. I mean, each day the loch is different, each season it throws up different colours and reflections, so you see yourself differently in it. Wild swimmer and writer Roger Deakin says natural water has always held the magical power to cure. Perhaps that's why I've been so taken by it during my recovery. Maybe I too have been looking for a cure. It's interesting because while I've lived near water in the past, I don't think I've ever been so connected to it as I am since my cancer and since moving here. It wasn't that long after we moved to live by the loch that I started to be irresistibly drawn to the idea of swimming in it. And I wrote about it in my blog. One evening, sitting by the loch, the desire to wade in was overwhelming. I could feel my body leaning into the idea of icy water soothing the angry, tangled muscles on my back and breast. Having taken root, the idea became a clean and simple need. I needed to swim in the loch. So I asked David, my partner, for a new wetsuit for my birthday, so I could start to swim. Because while I may be daft, I'm not quite daft enough to think that swimming in 5 degrees without a wetsuit would be much fun. My new super thick thermal-lined wetsuit arrived well in advance of my birthday. I tried it on, wincing at the contortions I have to make to get it over my left shoulder and arm. It feels brutal and harsh to push and snap myself into the tight neoprene, and my back buckles with the compression. But I know this is what my body wants and needs. I decided that my first swim in the loch will be on my 50th birthday. My birthday treat will be a swim. So that's what I did on my 50th birthday. I came here to the shore where I am now. It's actually quite a difficult place to get into the loch. The shore's really stony and slippy, but I've developed a bit of a technique where I sort of turn on my back and paddle backwards till I'm deep enough to swim. Loch Ness itself can seem intimidatingly vast and dark, but actually along the edge here, it remains shallow enough for me to stand quite a long way. So I'm never out of my depth and I don't feel intimidated by it, certainly not anymore. In fact, far from it, this stretch of water has become my comfort blanket. It's a place of solace. Today is beautifully calm. There's ripples on the water, but it's not wavy. But on that first swim on my 50th birthday, it was pretty wild. As I totter into the waves, I'm waiting for the cold to hit. I've swum in the loch without a wetsuit in the past, most memorably when I coaxed David and a handful of friends into a New Year's Day duck 18 months ago, each of us barely able to stand it long enough for the requisite full submersion. Can it really only be 18 months since then? Each time I look back to my life before cancer, I wince. I can't even type it here without crying with grief for the loss of that carefree, cancer-free existence. I long to be able to run shrieking into these waves again. I long to do anything which isn't shadowed by fragility and discomfort. To my surprise, the loch wasn't cold. Certainly nothing like as cold as I was expecting. Perfectly warm in my new wetsuit, Even when I'm immersed up to my neck, I raise my arms in triumph and they cheer and laugh on the shore. It was brief, but beautiful. And now I know that the loch isn't too cold. I feel I've been given an escape. Any day I want, I can walk down through the coconut scent of the gorse bushes that line the track across the road and drop down to the shore. And I've used that escape a lot over the past year, both here and in other lochs nearby. You know, I thought that once I was treated for cancer and the cancer was gone, I'd be fine. I'd just crack on with life. But cancer doesn't disappear when treatment ends. The ripple effects go on and on and on, which I just wasn't prepared for. And I think the wild swimming has just been a way of me processing everything that's happened. Now, I'm no great swimmer. After surgery, I'm a bit of a bird with a broken wing. So I'm not going to go in for long, just long enough this morning. I'm just popping on some gloves because my hands get so cold at this time of year. And these days, you know, it's not just about cancer, but it's about COVID, lockdown, schooling, the day-to-day stresses of life in a body that just doesn't work as well as I want it to. When it all gets too much, I reach for my wetsuit and I try to wash some of those worries away. I tell you what, it doesn't get any warmer though. Here we go, wish me luck. And each time when I emerge back out of the cold water and climb back up to the house, I feel changed. The water has sanded at my rough edges somehow. Just like the softened edges of the glacial stones on the shore, I too am softening, edging my way towards some peace. But I'm not there yet.
Penny Latin there, and the healing power of Loch Ness. Wild water everywhere. Don't know if you recall, but I spoke to a young trainee doctor who'd done
a thesis that,
on
yeah.
it. Yeah. Basically, you know, the idea is it's the shock of going into the cold yeah. water that kind of builds up your resilience. So it's in a, and it builds up your resilience in all sorts of levels.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I because I got quite into going for a swim outside yeah. last year, and I haven't been since December. Just because it got really stormy and everything, I yeah. just didn't fancy going in the sea when there was a big swell or anything like that. So I'm kind of brewing up to get back in,
yeah.
but I'm a bit scared as well because you got used to it because I was going every mm-hmm. week and you build up, you know, the power and the yeah. courage. But I think it's going to be really cool because apparently March is when the sea is at its coldest
yes.
as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just such an amazing feeling. And in fact, a friend of mine gave me, there's a you know, bunch of women we go together. Uh-huh. She gave me a picture the other day from last summer of us. We just come out the river and we just look so happy.
Takes years off you, so
yeah,
it does.
Exactly.
Let's go back to, I mean, a different type of water now, the Belty Burn on Deeside, where a 2 kilometre section of the burn has been restored back to its natural course. Now, the project was completed in November last year, and I said to Dr. Susan Cooksley, how long did it take before wildlife spotted the opportunities?
We saw lots of things, and we saw them from the very start. So there are badger sets down at the bottom of the site, but also on that hillside that you can see over there. And the badgers were out and about all the time, because, of course, we were creating mud, and that meant we could see...
Lots of worms, lots of beetles.
And also we could see the footprints.
Yeah.
But we had otters. Once we'd got these wetlands dug and we had fresh sand, we could see otter prints. We were absolutely delighted to see a kingfisher.
Uh-huh.
Dipper moved in. Uh-huh. And at the very end of the works, we had spawning salmon, which was...
Seriously? How quickly did that happen?
We finished the works just at the time of year when salmon are spawning. It's very predictable, the weeks of the year when salmon would spawn at this site. And if you look at a map of spawning sites of the whole Belty catchment, there are... plenty of sites down at the bottom, plenty of sites up at the top, but there's this desert in the middle where salmon haven't spawned for many, many, many years. But they have to get through this part of the Belty to spawn at the top. And presumably, as they worked their way up, they came upon the new habitat that we'd created, and they thought, well, this is perfect, and got on with the job.
How exciting was that for an ecologist?
It was... the most exciting moment of the whole project, and we jumped around and were very excited indeed because we were standing, we'll see it in a minute, at an area of riverbed, and we could see a a cock salmon guarding a red, and it was the ultimate endorsement for what we'd done. But I'm not even going to call it the dream, but it's always a possibility that at some point in the future we've got, as you'll know from the area that you're from, we've got cranes starting to breed and move their way into the northeast. And when we were putting this together, it was suggested that if we added in some island habitat, it would just give that opportunity, should cranes start to move in this direction, that there was, we might have some safe nesting sites that would might be available. So we're thinking very long term, fingers crossed, a bit of ambition, but why not?
You've taken something that was ruler straight and you've bent it round. Now, you were showing me earlier Roy's map of the area, which really shows how twisty-turny this burn was originally. I mean, it's extraordinary. But right now, it's still looking pretty clean and tidy. It hasn't wilded itself up yet. You know, you don't have dead trees lying here and that kind of thing. Can I use the B word? Beavers.
Oh, please do.
Would you like to see beavers back on this?
Absolutely. Yes, it's very raw.
I wish folk could have seen your face there when I said, can I use the B word? Went, which B word?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the site is really raw at the moment. The ground has been completely destroyed and put back together again. And now what it really needs is time to heal and time for nature to move back in. You asked about the wildlife that we saw during the construction works. I expect that part of the reason we saw so much was because it was on the move. It had been displaced. Animals were also having a look around to see if there might be something here that was worth coming to. So now what we need is, several years really, but certainly the next few months, just to give the land and the wildlife as little disturbance as possible so things can start to settle. This isn't a static set of habitats that are all perfect and will never change. This is a dynamic site that's going to change hugely. It's not going to look anything like this in 6 months, a year, 2 years.
Yeah. But when you look at this and you think back on the last summer, you know, the sort of the COVID summer, or the first COVID summer, most likely. How do you feel when you look at this?
Oh, I just feel absolutely delighted that we were able to really achieve something that's going to be, it's going to be benefiting wildlife and people and the whole river system for hopefully hundreds of years to come. But also, it gives us somewhere where we can show people what's possible. And hopefully that means that we may find that other farmers who in future might say, okay, I'll have a go at that. I like what you've done. Now I can see it, what the practicalities are on the ground, I'll go for that.
Dr. Susan Cooksley there of the James Hutton Institute and Deeside Catchment Partnership. It's a great, great project. They've done remarkably well.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that sense of pride that they must have and actually doing that.
Yeah, no, too straight.
And set an example to other places, I suppose.
Hopefully. You know, it'd be quite nice if it did. Time now to reveal this week's mystery bird.
Well, well done to Gary and Pennycook, who got it right.
Yep. Without the clue.
Yeah, without the clue. Actually, way before 7 o'clock, he was in there with the right answer. And the right answer being the
Brambley.
Yes.
Well, I got correct answers from Isabel from Creef, Johnston from Dalton, East Lothian. Mary Frame, Gifford East Lothian, saying, I'm so chuffed this week. The hedgehogs are back in my garden and looking healthy. Cheered me up no end. Good news, Mary. Fred and Armadale got it. Katie in Perth. Graham and Denny. Pamela from Edinburgh. And Hazel from Aberdeen.
Alistair and Christorfin. Surely the birds are brambling. Yes, it is indeed. Brambling, says Margaret Lear of Rankfoot. And she says she's better at words than birdsong. So it was the clue that gave it away there. Leslie from Edinburgh says, morning, folks. Is the mystery bird a brambling? Yes, it is. I'm starting a campaign to have Flora as chief presenter.
Ah, no, steady now. Steady now. Steady now. Number two, I would thoroughly accept. But say, not chief presenter,
sure. Yeah. Alison in New Aylith, brambling. Sandy Faye Dunglass, yes, think the birds are brambling. Colin, is it a brambling? Beautiful sunny morning here in Kirk Newton. Great show as always. And Margaret in Bucky says the bird sound is a brambling.
It is indeed a brambling. And this, I think, is rapidly becoming, as I said last week, one of my favourite birds. Here's Ewan with some brambling facts.
O 0700, and the dispatcher at Dresden Police Headquarters repeats the order to a questioning officer. Close the Autobahn at Junction 2. Details to follow. Over the next 10 minutes, six cars are sent to different sections of the high-speed motorway. Their object, to close the road as quickly as possible before the morning rush hour. When the first traffic police arrive, an incredible sight meets their eyes. Millions of birds, bramblings, the mountain finch, cover the tarmac. In winter, flocks of up to 10 million of these small finches gather on the roads seeking warmth and the seeds of roadway weeds. Eventually, the birds move on and life returns to normal. Now, we don't get the same numbers here, but flocks of 10 or so of these winter visitors are not unknown. But you're most likely to spot this finch with the tiger-like plumage amongst a flock of chaffinches, who adopt their Scandinavian cousins for the cold season. Similar in size and shape to the chaffinch, males have a bright orange and white breast, while the females are similar but slightly less vibrant. In flight, you get a long white rump. Flocks of brambling head to the UK each year to escape the deep snows of the north and take advantage of the food on offer in our woods. It's hard to believe, but these charming little birds, the thorn finches, were once trapped for food. With one quote saying, "As an article of food, some persons profess to admire the flesh of the brambling, but the taste is bitter and not likely to become generally accepted." But like so many of our small birds, they were kept in cages for their song. And they were also traded extensively. Here's one Victorian account of a so-called bird lover. Mr. Butler continued to tell of his other experiences. "In 1886, I purchased a charming male bird of this species, so gentle and tame that its plumage was always in perfect condition. It was very fond of bathing and sang regularly in the spring. It was, as it turned out, unfortunate that I kept this example in a cage, as at its third molt, all its quills grew out like fans, giving the bird a most wild and uncanny aspect. Indeed, it was such an object that I gave it to a child who had taken a fancy for it as a toy." Now, of course, totally illegal in this country for decades. But the trapping of finches using liquid glue and decoys was made illegal in France by the European Court of Justice this week.
That's extraordinary they took that long to actually save it. How bizarre. But they are beautiful wee birds.
I mean, the last time I saw one, I'm trying to think, it was on a railway line to Peterhead. You know, it was two males in one of the a hawthorn bush. Just gorgeous wee animals.
I need to keep a close eye out for them. We've had a lovely email from Neil in Nairn. He says, "Thanks for being the best show on radio." Well, thank you very much. "I'm rarely up early enough to listen live and often listen on the podcast while sitting in the conservatory watching the hooded crows attacking my bird feeder whilst failing to identify the bird sounds. I woke at 6:30 after a disturbed night's sleep. My mum is seriously ill. She has cancer. And I excitedly tuned in to catch you live. Great piece on outdoor swimming. I live in Nairn and swim in the Big Blue every week, year round. It's undoubtedly a calling and draws you in and heals. I worry about mum, but your show and sea swimming resets my mind."
I'm glad to hear that, actually. And pass on our best wishes to your mum.
Yeah.
Well, it's not an easy time.
No, not at all. And Amanda says, "Great piece on wild swimming. We are the Murray Mermaids, who are big fans of wild swimming. Have noticed how it seems to attract more women than men, but
it
not
does.
Sure if that's right. Or if that's just around here. Seems to be everywhere, doesn't it?"
Yeah, I honestly think it does. You know, and I'm not sure why that should be the case.
Well, it's very funny because this little group where we go swimming, the men folk, they just can't stand it.
No.
They shiver looking at us doing it. It's very funny.
They do that anyway. Kieran Inverness, this is interesting. A lot of folk thought it was a dipper. Kieran and Vanessa thought it was a dipper. Trisha and Nettie Bridge thought it was a dipper. Not quite the sound I hear in the Nettie River, but maybe. Betty May and Lerwick. Nope. Alex Meeklejohn and Dunfermline. And Mandy from Devon. How interesting.
I didn't think it was that similar to a dipper, but, you know, obviously it resonates differently with different people. I don't know. Yeah. A bit like wild water swimming.
Yes, exactly.
That's it, I'm afraid, for us this week. Please don't forget the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which will be at noon today. And we've also got a midweek podcast, which this week features a fantastic woman called Alice Morrison, explorer and an adventurer. Fascinating tales there. Interesting life with camels. Anyway, from all the team here, thanks for listening.